This is Polly Young Eisendrath, October 11th, 2000. What Women Really Want. Tape 3 of 4.
So what's the opposite of that? The opposite of projective identification and being locked in is openness, is space, is the sense that there's an open framework and we can discover something new. In a sense that we can be so surprised by what happens that we neither one of us could have predicted it. When Jung talks about the transcendent function, he talks about holding the openness so that you don't react in terms of either of the opposites. Winnicott talks about holding open meaning so that you don't foreclose on it and think you know in advance what this means. There are stories in Buddhism, there are stories in Taoism about holding open this space with a sort of receptivity that maybe it's this way and maybe it's that way, a not knowing, a sense of uncertainty. Okay, let me look at this again because I don't know, I'm not sure. This kind of attitude actually brings about discovery of new meaning. And in a relationship, it brings about the real interest in the mystery of your relationship, that you could discover something that neither of you knew in advance by being with each other. But in order for that to happen, you have to hold the space open. You cannot go into the complex as being locked in. And once you start to lock in, the way to open the space is through this business of dialogue and empathy and so on. That's really your only chance. Now, if you're very, very good at meditation, possibly you can open the space with your partner through meditation. But very often what people do is use the meditative skill as a passive-aggressive weapon with the partner. You know, they just sort of stop talking and they're going to go into a meditative space and the other person's going like, well, what's going on with you right now?
Also, you know, in Buddhism, certainly there is often a great misunderstanding of anger.
Yeah.
All anger is bad. Don't be angry. Where actually, when we distinguish anger from aggression, I understand it as aggression is problematic in human relationships. That instinctual response, that knee-jerk, active or passive aggression is always problematic in terms of creating good relationships. But anger, as we understand it, is a very useful emotion, which is not aggressive, which says, I don't like this, this is not okay with me, sets a boundary, sets a limit, and it's transformative when it's done well. It's a great skill to do it. So I work with a number, in Vermont there's a lot of Buddhist communities, a number of them, and a particular couple, and the man is so passive aggressive, and you know, he doesn't want to be angry, but he doesn't assert himself in any way. He never says what he wants because he doesn't want to stress, and it's all rationalized under I don't want to be angry or get
hurtful or whatever.
Yeah.
So the thing also about anger, when you do get angry, you're going to encounter a frustration on the other person's part. Because rarely are people so open that when someone gets angry with them specifically, they just say, tell me more about it. You know, I mean, most people, when you get angry and you say, okay, I don't like what you said, the other person is generally not going to say, tell me more about it. You know, usually they're going to defend themselves at that point. So then you have to be willing to stay with the situation with the attitude, again, of the anthropologist eventually. So do tell me more about, you know, let's go forward from this. I don't like this, but let me understand what it is you're doing here or something like that.
This is an example of how a relationship is a great spiritual practice.
Right.
The potential for working on your own problems with patience, tolerance, and tolerating your own emotional arousal without acting it out. These are great opportunities to practice. Something that I would call has aspects of a spiritual practice.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a different kind of practice than monastic practice, you know, but it's also a spiritual practice. So, okay, so that pretty much like covers the issues that are involved from the movement, from romance to disillusionment to intimacy. And We want to just show a couple of video clips, mostly just to entertain you a little bit, because these aren't ideal, but they really add a little bit of drama. The first one is we're going to show you what happened between, if you don't know from the Fisher King the movie, what actually happens between the two people that you saw last night. Somebody in the audience last night asked me the question of,
explain what took place last night.
Yeah. Around the issue of when a woman says, you know, when she gives an ultimatum and says, I want a committed relationship, as Mercedes Ruel did in the scene with Jeff Bridges, and she says, you know, I'm setting a line here. If you're not going to commit yourself to me, then it's over. And if you recall, there was someone asking about, you know, isn't that putting pressure on the man? And we had a little bit of a discussion, and I said that her assumption that the woman was putting pressure is some kind of assumption that the woman has some major power that actually puts the man in some bad situation when the woman just makes her desires known. And actually, what happens in the movie is that for the people that weren't there last night, this is the movie The Fisher King, in which Jeff Bridges plays a kind of narcissistic radio talk show host, an arrogant kind of a guy who causes some murders to be committed in New York City through some things that he says on the show. And when he realizes that, he takes a real plunge into despair and also addiction. And so Mercedes Ruel plays a video store owner, a woman who doesn't have a lot of material goods in life but has a really open heart. And she takes Jeff Bridges in, and she gives him a job, and she cleans him up, and she kind of loves him back to life again. And once he comes back to life, he says to her, now I think I need to take some time on my own. And he puts it first like we both need to take a little time here to figure out what we're doing. And she says, you know, I thought that we had a relationship, that we love each other, and so whatever time you take, just take it in our relationship. You don't need to do something like get some space for yourself, which is the metaphor that, unfortunately, I think it's reinforced by popular psychology, like John Gray, the man needs to go to his cave. Well, why don't the women have caves, too? You know, I mean, nobody really has to get away from anybody else as long as you can create the space in the relationship. What the woman says, she confronts the man, she says, look, if you're going to hurt me now. You're not going to get out of this being a nice guy. If the relationship is over, just say it's over. If you want to commit yourself to me, commit yourself, but if not, leave because it's over.
That's where the scene ended last night, for those of you who were here. And someone said in the discussion afterward, he said, well, the guy is very, the fear is that the guy's going to leave when you make this kind of
statement of your needs.
Statement, yeah. Which is sometimes confused with a demand or an ultimatum, which it's really not. It's just a statement of, this is how I see it, this is what I want.
It's actually like anger. It's boundary setting. It's right. Saying, I won't. I mean, the way I see commitment is that we didn't talk about attachment and separation anxiety, but when you're in a relationship where you're having sex regularly, basically, you become open then to an attachment bond, and generally, most people will feel an attachment bond with the other person, which also opens you to feelings of threat to that bond. So you need the commitment to form the container around the relationship. Otherwise, you open yourself up to constant separation anxiety, which are feelings of despair and rage and apathy, which go with separation anxiety from early development as well. So when people live in uncommitted relationships over time where they're having sex with each other, they tend to feel a lot of separation anxiety constantly. There's a threat to their bond that's constant because there's no containment for that bond. So when somebody says, I don't want to live like that, I want a commitment because I'm committed here, that's really setting that kind of boundary. And in a sense, it is an ultimatum in the sense that, you know, I'm taking responsibility for myself, and I won't stay somewhere where I can't live with some emotional equanimity. So that really is what the woman, the Mercedes Ruel character, wasn't doing it perfectly well like Ragnell might have done it, because she was enraged also. And she blamed him to some extent, and she fought him to some extent. But the main thing she did, each time she recovered her own ego function, she said, no, you're not going to get to be a nice guy. You're going to leave if you're leaving. And I am not going to just go to wait around to find out what you want to do with me. If it's over, she says, let's call it over.
One of the other things that people say in these in these presentations often is that men aren't going to really react well to women being so direct. Many men are not going to be able to deal with it, and it must be very hard for women who are really direct to have relationships. Because actually the two videos that we show do show, we don't show the whole thing, but they show their examples of when women do confront or challenge, and in one the man doesn't appear to come through, and in this one it doesn't appear to come through either, because that's the way we usually end it. We've never showed this particular one, but we thought it would be a good idea, because it doesn't end the way often people fear it will when a woman directly asserts her needs. And it's a very short thing. It probably takes about a minute. But
so here's the way it comes out from the scene last night with eventually, when she sets this boundary, he does come to an awareness. And so here's the scene where he comes back to see her again after several months. One thinks.
Yeah, they've been separated for several months. She runs a video store.
The cookies are good. Thank you. we've decided that there will be no more movies.
No,
I'm not kidding. No, I don't think we have time to add any more movies.
We're going to show videos.
A video of us working with a couple, but
us.
It's not so entertaining as the movies.
Not nearly as entertaining as the movies.
Yeah. If we have time at the end, we'll show a couple of scenes. There's a really great scene from Living Out Loud. If you haven't seen the movie, there's a scene in the elevator where she tries to speak honestly to her now ex-husband. And it's a great scene. But it doesn't really fit in with this afternoon's agenda. So you can tell we like movies. So what we're going to start with is discussion. Questions or comments or anything, testimonies from this morning, anything that you would like to talk about. And then we're going to go into actually talking about dialogue and the more sort of pedestrian aspects of the how it works. No. What we teach them is method, not vocabulary. And something that we do say very clearly is you don't have to learn the language of your partner. You only have to understand the language of your partner. Because many times, particularly men, will come being almost afraid that they're going to be made to speak differently, you know, that they're going to be made to say things about their feelings and things like that. And from our point of view, whatever language a person has, and different cultures and different ethnic backgrounds and so on speak more or less about feelings or more or less about a whole lot of things. Like one Swedish man once said to us that his father was considered very expressive because once he almost told his wife that he loved her, you know. You know, there are different ethnic backgrounds that in regard to these languages. So what we say to people is that as a participant in a dialogue, you do need to know how to listen and to understand what your partner says. And then from your own perspective, you need to know how to speak, to be able to speak of what your experience is. But you don't have to speak your partner's language. Wait, no, not our language either. No, not at all. Yeah.
There's
Well, Francie does in Portland.
Oregon. Yeah,
Francie Corman in Portland, and she has a little group of people that work with dialogue therapy. And we'd be happy to come out here and teach therapists to do it. What it takes is somebody, Lucretia asked me in the break, but here's what it takes. And usually people are very enthusiastic about learning it, and then we never get asked back to teach it. Not never, because we've taught it a lot. But this is not franchised. It's not imago therapy. It does not work as a business. It's just a method. And it takes about 3.5 to 4 days, depending on how the schedule is set up, for us to do an introduction. And that introduction consists of theoretical background and then the actual method. We do no administrative promotion or backup. All we do is show up, and it has to all be set up. We need a demonstration couple willing to work with us for 8 hours of demonstration. And then that couple also has to be able to discuss with us and the group what's gone on. And so it's very exposing of their relationship. That's usually where I think people back down on inviting us, is they can't find the demonstration couple. But what we've found is the people in the past that have been the demonstration couple are the people who become the real engine of dialogue therapy in that area. So, being the demonstration couple ends up being a really terrific way to learn it, and many times these are the people that end up really using it themselves. So we do this introduction, and then if everything goes well and people incorporate dialogue therapy into their work, we can supervise from long distance, or we can suggest local supervisors if there are some in your area, which there aren't here, but there's a place in Missoula, Montana, and there is in Portland. And then we come back in a year to do a follow-up. And the follow-up is, again, about 3 days.
Yeah, that training. So far, we have not done an experiential. We don't really do experiential techniques. But the dialogue therapy training for therapists is an experiential thing. But we've never done anything.
We have.
Experiential.
Omega. And it was not good.
Oh, yeah, that's true. We did it once, and that's why we decided not to do it. Because the situations, that the people that came to it, the problems were so complex. Trying to get answers in a weekend workshop, it wasn't a disaster.
It was just like we were in some sort of therapy hell, because we were working with people who had tremendous problems. They hadn't been in therapy. We were now exposing them in this group. And it was just terrible for us. I mean, we just barely crawled out of Omega after the weekend, and we said we'd never do it again. Because this form of therapy, as I said in the beginning, all of the methods that we use in this particular format are these anxiety-provoking methods where the couples actually will be in a dynamic field where they're going to discharge their complexes. And so it's a setup for you to expose what's, a really unconscious issue. And at Omega, what happened is that people were, there were some people who had a lot of childhood trauma and had never dealt with it, and suddenly it was all out there, and we didn't know what to say about it, and so on. So that's why we don't do that. So there was one there, too, but... Okay. Yes, I am. Well, I haven't read the book. I'm familiar with it. I've seen the Sharpe's work.
No,
I know.
He's talking about the Sharpe's.
Yeah, he is.
No.
I thought you were talking about David Sharpe.
No.
Snark, I don't know.
Sex therapist who's now...
Then you know.
I know of him, but I don't know anything really about his work, so I would not be able to...
But David Sharpe has a book out on sex and couple relationships. So I thought you were referring to that book. Dave and Jill Sharpe are object relations therapists.
Sharp. You're talking about Schnarf.
Schnarf.
Schnarch. Schnarch.
Snarch.
We should be familiar with that. It's a big name.
Oh,
Schnarch.
No.
Yeah.
I thought that it was the same book that David Sharpe has out, but obviously it's not that book, and no, I don't know. Is there some reason why you think this would be... Sounds really similar. One thing is, it seems to me to be the case that a lot of people who work with couples have very, when you've worked with couples over time, it's like seeing the furniture in the room. You see the same furniture. And you may have slightly different words for it, but it's the same furniture. And this sounds like it's probably quite similar.
Bowen.
Murray
Bowen is a family theorist.
I don't.
I try not to. I don't think it's a good idea. And, but sometimes in the practical reality of some situations, I will. But it's just not a good idea. It's messy.
As a rule for dialogue therapy, it's just like apples and oranges or whatever, because when I'm, you know, when I'm working with someone individually, I'm setting up an analytic framework. In dialogue therapy, we actually are somewhat self-disclosing. When you see us together as a couple anyway, well, obviously we're a couple. And I mean, sometimes when people come into the room, the way that Ed and I deal with each other, they may not know we're married because we have different last names. And I will say we are a married couple, which makes it possible for them not to be so anxious about the fact that we're having some conflict that's so obvious. That if we were professional associates, we would be in terrible trouble if we were talking to each other that way. But, you know, being married, you know, like, it's okay for them to sound like that together. But I feel like dialogue therapy is fairly revealing of us. And so I don't like to be that revealed to start individual therapy. However, sometimes a couple can make really good use of some adjunctive individual sessions that are adjunctive to the couples therapy, and then we can come back to the couples therapy, and all of that is to be shared. It's not a secret. So that's the way that we will sometimes use the individual meetings in relation to the couples therapy. But I think both of us over time have experimented with trying to see an individual in a couple that we have seen over, you know, when we see the couple in dialogue therapy, then there's an individual X wants now to come into therapy with one of us. And usually there are problems from that, we have just found. Yeah. Ooh, that was what the movie clip was going to be about. Okay, she said that could we say anything more about the infantilizing of the male partner and making him the little boy? I'll just say a few. I just say a couple things about it. Do you want to say something?
No, I was looking like this. I was thinking, but I wasn't thinking I wanted to say something.
Okay.
I was thinking maybe we should show that small part.
I know. I thought.
Not the second part, but just the small part at the Thanksgiving. You think it's worth it?
It's funny. Yeah, probably it is. But, okay, we'll probably show a little bit of it. Okay, this is the thing that tends to happen. And actually, in Women in Desire, in the chapter that's called Hothouse Mothering and the Divine Child, that chapter actually does deal with a case. And the case I call the little boy, when he is a little boy, Henry. And Henry is very precocious and intelligent. And his mother, who I think I call Marjorie in the book, she has Henry in her 30s, and she's absolutely, you know, kind of magnetized to Henry's potentials and capacities. And he immediately becomes a divine child complex for her. And the divine child, of course, is a Jungian idea, which is the archetype of new beginnings, of the promise of something new. And you can see the images of the divine child in world religions, Siddhartha, when he was born, you know, he got up and walked and said, I am the world-honored one. And Jesus attracted the three kings who recognized that he was, you know, more important than anybody else. And so the divine child as a figure shows up in religion and also a lot in dreams.
He was much more important than everybody else.
That's right. At that particular moment in history, he was very important. So this archetypal image, which will show up in people's dreams as an extraordinary child, can get associated with an actual child, you know, and then the mother, in this case it's the mother in particular, becomes preoccupied with promoting this child's potential. And you may have known a few mothers like this. And then, you know, all of her waking hours go into finding the best nursery school and the best organic cooking and the best this and the... I mean, I actually do get sort of surrounded by mothers in their 30s at the Y where I work out. So in the locker room, they're all trading all these recipes and these notes. And these are women that probably, some of them have their PhDs now, they were probably totally engaged in various kinds of really intelligent activities until they had this child. And now they're totally engaging all that intelligence into that one child who has become a project. Now, in the case in the book, Henry also has two siblings that Marjorie had later. And by the time she comes to therapy, she's in her 40s, and she has actually hit one of the kids, and that's what brought her to therapy. But basically, she sees herself as the problem. She doesn't think Henry has any problems, although Henry's a very aggressive little boy. Now, if Henry were to grow up and he had given over his autonomy to the divine child complex, he would actually, in himself, feel like he was driven by things that weren't really, later he would feel, they weren't really authentically his. And there's a British psychoanalyst named Neville Symington who calls this the discordant source, this divine child complex in the adult. And I use the story in the book of Rumpelstiltskin to show what happens to the child who is sacrificed to the power needs of, in this case, the mother, it can be the father, and who is promoted as the divine child of this mother. As an adult, such a person feels somewhat like a little king. On one hand, feels exempt from the ordinary limitations of life and may have fairly conscious feelings of superiority. From working with such people in therapy, I would say they're usually conscious of their feelings of superiority. And in fact, even if those feelings of superiority hurt them a great deal, that is, they feel isolated and unable to get help from others because they don't think anyone else could actually help because they feel so superior, even under those circumstances, they cannot let go of the feelings of superiority. They cannot see how they are limited like other human beings and mistaken and so on. And at the same time, there'll be some sort of rage internally that is often enacted on family members. Such a person may be a president of a university, a bank president, a very successful writer, particularly novelist, poet sometimes, seem to be a lot of people in that kind of work that have this. And they may even be quite garrulous and entertaining and able to be charming publicly, and people are very attracted to them. But then privately, they have a little nasty side that comes out that kind of takes possession of things. And the Neville Symington says that the identifying characteristic is the word jest. Like, I was just teasing you when I said you shouldn't have that dessert. Or I was just opening my umbrella here in the doorway when you walked into it. Or I just want a little bit of... The just is meant to reduce the aggression that this person feels in regard to his or her own needs. So the grown-up divine child is in a lot of trouble in relationships, particularly intimate relationships, and often doesn't really know why and doesn't know how to get out of that trouble.
Often doesn't know the difference between admiration and love.
love, right, right. Seeks admiration and idealization from others and has the sense that that's love. Has to be admired a great deal, many doses of admiration a day and so on. Well, what really is going on is internally there's a kind of gap where there should have been an ego complex. There's a kind of gap. There's difficulty regulating self-esteem, so there have to be a lot of narcissistic supplies delivered regularly to kind of keep self-esteem at a barely, functional level. And that self-esteem drops so quickly, and then more supplies have to come in.
The man in this movie is like kind of grown-up Devon Chopra.
So, should we show this little clip? No? No? No. Let's take a show of hands. Let's take a show of hands. Some people say no, some people say yes. Okay, first of all, let's go for the yes people. The yes people. It looks
more.
Pretty
don't
close.
Even
all right.
You're the only one who doesn't want to see it.
No. I think it's just that it'll lead us off in a direction.
No, as long
and
as
we
you
do
don't
have
stay on this topic too much longer.
Well, anyway.
Okay.
No. This is not this is a movie that I show when I do the workshop on mothers and children, on the idealization of mothers and children, and it's a movie called One True Thing, which I would like to call. Point. Well, let me sort of back up a little bit. Meryl Streep is married to William Hurt. And William Hurt is a college professor, an English professor, who has early on published some fiction that was very well regarded. Gosh, I mean, I just feel like this is almost an archetype itself because I see so many people who are in this kind of range. Anyway, he's a young man regarded as a very important, promising writer, but he has never produced anything else. And now he's probably in his late 40s, early 50s. And I was getting to that, but he has this novel that he's been working on for years called The Long Way In. That's the name of an inn in Vermont. It's called The Comeback In is what the novel is called. Come Back In.
I'm working on it for like 15 years.
Yeah, and he never gets it done. And anyway, Renee Zellweger is like the father's daughter. She's admired her father. She's herself become a writer in New York. And she's in her 20s. There's a son, her brother, who's younger, who's supposedly at Harvard. He's actually dropped out, but nobody knows that. And then the mother, Meryl Streep, has cancer. In the movie, it's not clear what kind of cancer, but she gets diagnosed. She's clearly in a very advanced stage of cancer. And as soon as it's very clear that she has to have difficult chemotherapy, the father tells the daughter he wants her to come home and take care of her mother. And Renee Zellweger at first tries to oppose it, but the father says, don't you have a heart? Like, what's wrong with you that you wouldn't come take care of your mother? So she comes home and gradually comes to see who her mother is and what her mother's been doing from the point of view that her mother is a little red hen and does everything for everyone. And at the same time, the daughter in the movie is kind of ambiguous in her. She seems to be critical of it, but on the other hand, she gradually identifies with her mother, takes the whole thing on herself by the end of the movie. And the father she sees has been having affairs and is an alcoholic, and so she very quickly sees through her father's persona and sees who he has actually been in the marriage, and she tries to alert her mother to this as well.
One of the things about the father is that no one really holds him accountable.
Right.
Daughter tries to, but doesn't succeed. And this is
in confronting him.
And
so, really, we're showing this scene now to show you a dynamic that happens with the woman infantilizing the husband. He ends up being like the little boy who has to get his way. Now his daughter wants to confront him about this, but she doesn't really have the ammunition. She's not his partner. And so in this scene, the mother's kind of advanced cancer is pulling everybody kind of inward in the family, and it's Thanksgiving, and the daughter has made it, or the father has made an agreement with his daughter that they will have Thanksgiving by themselves, no outsiders, only her boyfriend and their family. And now the father's coming in and telling them that a really well-known poet is downstairs and is going to be joining them for Thanksgiving.
The scene starts with the mother and the two kids in the bedroom. They're all talking and kind of
making fun of the
making
father.
Making fun of the father. Because the mother doesn't, no one confronts him directly. He's allowed to beat his little boy self, but they make fun of him and put him down in front of him. So just some dynamics of this situation.
Oh, then do you play the scene afterwards in the bar then too? What you see then is you see the daughter playing this out with her boyfriend. In a sense, she's trying to defend herself. But in the end, when her mother asks her what was going on with her boyfriend, she makes an excuse for him. And you kind of see that she's going to fall into the same pattern of making excuses for her partner also.
And as long as we're doing this, we may as well show you the little clip after that. It's a different way of approaching this. Mm-mm. Confronting. You don't want to do the thing in the
no,
elevator.
It's the wrong. That's a different clip. The elevator clip comes with the other scene. The clip here is the bathroom clip that we did last night.
That's what comes after the
right.
Bar scene?
Yeah.
Goes into the bathroom?
Yeah. So just stop it. Stop this after after she's sitting on the toilet and her mother says, just stop it there.
Right.
We have all these film clips on these little videos where we have them sequenced. Probably illegal, but... Anyway, so we're going to see, this is the little boy man. Dynamic. And there are probably 1,000 things to talk about in regard to that, but we won't have time to do that and talk about anger and aggression and dialogue therapy. So... if it's okay with you, then I'm just going to shift over and talk a little bit about the difference between anger and aggression. And some of you did get this sheet, though you all got it now, because it was all Xerox for everybody, right? The salmon-colored sheet? No, it wasn't.
Salmon.
Oh, it's not salmon anymore. But it's called Protecting the Intimate Space Using Anger, Not Aggression. And there, did you want to ask a question in the green sweater in the back? Hello? You just wanted to get the handout? Okay. Okay. So I'm just going to summarize it briefly. You can take the handout home. It explains it. This business about keeping open the space in the couple relationship and not enacting things based on childhood complexes has a lot to do, in ordinary language, with not being aggressive with a partner. And aggression is expressed in two ways: active aggression through attack and passive aggression through withdrawal. This is the fight or flight response you see in animals. You all probably recognize that animals and humans express aggression, and aggression is a response to fear. When people or animals feel afraid, they use aggression to defend themselves. The fighting kind of aggression is the attack outward. In human beings, it can be blaming, criticizing, using physical force, obscenity, also psychoanalyzing one's partner, attacking through conceptual things. Aggression that is expressed actively is like the hitting out. So if you hit somebody's identity, you know, if you kind of hit outward at their identity, they're going to feel that as aggression. And in response to your aggression, the other person is going to be aggressive because they're going to feel afraid. And so they're going to either be passively aggressive and withdraw or withhold, or they're going to be actively aggressive and fight you back. Aggression begets aggression, and it's really pretty predictable whether it's in war or it's in family conflict. And so when you realize what aggression is, that it's a response to fear, you can begin to actually work with it better, because you won't arouse other people's fear if you don't do something aggressive. passive aggression has to do with withholding, withdrawing, procrastinating, forgetting. Passive aggression often takes the form of, I didn't do anything at all. Why are you mad at me? I didn't do anything here. I didn't say anything here. That very irritating way of kind of blowing up a smoke screen based on, you know, whatever one's needs are that are now being talked about as though there are no needs at all. Passive aggression ultimately can be expressed as suicide, where you take the self out of play altogether. And if you've ever had a suicide in your family or with people close to you, you feel it as the aggressive act that it is. It's an aggression turned against the self, and yet there are others at whom that suicide is aimed. And the more we do research on suicide, the more we see how that works. So passive and active aggression are responses to fear. Sometimes also suicide is a response to shame, which I talked about last night. But they really, aggressive acts are not useful in promoting intimacy, because intimacy is based on this equality and mutuality. Aggression actually sets up a dominance and submission routine. Parents act aggressively with their children when they're disciplining them, saying, you know, don't run across the street, or grabbing the child back from some impulsive action creates a feeling of dominance over the child's actions, and the child then submits to that. So as adults, when somebody screams at us, we tend to feel that they're taking over. Or when someone leaves the room in the middle of a conversation, same kind of effect. So what we say to people is that you need to promise yourself, first of all, that you won't use aggression in your relationship, because you live in that relationship and you don't want it to be a place where there's a lot of mess. Now, generally, that in itself is a very big deal. Some people say, I can't promise because I know I'm going to do it again. And we don't really mean that you promise, like, you know, you're signing some sort of legal document that you're going to be sued if you ever use aggression again. It's more like you set your intention. My intention is not to use aggression in this relationship. And by setting that intention, you begin a process of change. And so what can you do then when you're in a conflict of need with your partner? Because if there's one thing that's for certain, if you're going to live in the house with other people, your needs are going to be in conflict. So if you're in a conflict of need with your partner, how do you deal with that instead of being aggressive? And the way that we recommend is that you use anger. And anger is this emotion that the Greeks called the moral emotion, because the Greeks recognized something that we seem to forget in this period of time when we're so genetically oriented and biologically oriented. The Greeks recognized that animals don't get angry, that it's a human emotion, anger is. And anger is a response to a sense of unfairness or injustice, where you feel that something unfair and you is going on, and you respond to it really by setting a boundary. No, don't do that. I don't like that. I wouldn't want to do that. Or I won't tolerate this. Or I find this insulting. You notice all these are I statements. These are not statements about the other person.
Something that's important to add into this definition of anger is that it's a response to the perception of unfairness.
Fairness, right.
You might actually be misperceiving what's happening. So getting angry at what you believe is a violation, which maybe it isn't.
Right.
The perception of unfairness that creates the anger.
And if you use anger, you won't create so much fear in response to your need. And then you may have frustration in your partner, but then there's the possibility of returning to finding out about whatever it is that's making you angry, because you're not going to get this terribly aggressive response typically in your partner. Occasionally you will, but anger allows you to deal with your conflict of need by just stopping the other person and stating an I statement. It is not about the other person. Although very often you also, if you're asked, well, what is this? Then you have to say what your perceptions of it are. You know, so, but ideally, again, as we go over this, you'll state this in terms of your own perceptions. Well, this is the way I'm understanding what's going on, or this is what I'm understanding you want from me, or this is what I thought you were doing here. Anger, in the way that we deal with it, is never an attack on the other person. It is a statement of your own perception, your own boundaries, your own bottom line. So
to use anger is an enormous strength. Most people don't use it. It's a transformative emotion. If you can use it well, you really can take a potentially disastrous situation and turn it into a really a breakthrough situation. But it's very difficult to do it. It's a very highly evolved function for someone to use that when they're stirred up.
And then, you know, we talked a little bit about the kind of more spiritualized confusions that people get into around passive aggression versus, you know, actually anger. And a lot of the spiritual systems confuse what we're talking about as aggression with anger, or they confuse hatred with anger. And so then there's this kind of conflation or, you know, misunderstanding about what anger is. And it's interesting because the Greeks actually saw this and didn't make this confusion that we're making now about anger and aggression that we, in this period of time, tend to make between anger and aggression. Did you want? You probably have seen it between us already, but... But do you want to try something in particular? Not really? There.
I think it would be better.
I was better. Now, it's not your business for your partner to be happy. That's your partner's business. But you can see how that can set up a whole chain of events that will eventually recreate for that individual the same kind of emotional experience as that individual has had as a child. Now, so what I've done is really kind of move from the discussion of archetype to the discussion of complex. So let me just kind of back up a little bit and say, I'm going to use the negative mother and the terrible mother archetype to illustrate this because it's really so easy to use. Everybody, everywhere, has had negative experiences of early development. Everybody's mother or mothering ones have failed in some way to support that individual. Winnicott says we're the environment that is the psychological environment fails, that's where the personality begins to develop. If your needs are met perfectly, there's no personality, there's no response. But so everybody's environment has failed to some extent. Everyone has either been overwhelmed or underwhelmed. You know, everybody has been at times left to cry or at other times intruded upon and so on. So everybody's had an experience that has activated, or experiences in early life that have activated the coherent formation of a terrible mother, of the image of the witch, the bitch, the nag, and the hag that I was talking about last night, a negatively overwhelming female. And it's usually female because the early caregivers are female and because the mother is female. All right, that image then will have personal signatures depending on your own environment. Your mother, your older sister, your aunt or your grandmother, whoever the caregivers were, they had their particular styles, their particular ways of being. You will then have formed a psychological complex around the core archetype of the terrible mother from your childhood. And my sense is that everybody's got a negative mother complex because everybody, at least in our culture, has been stuck in some way with some woman who was unhappy. Because she was isolated, she was at home, she wasn't. And, you know, I mean, even if you're not fundamentally unhappy, there are going to be times when the most caring, nurturant, happiest of mothers feels overwhelmed and kind of nonplussed by the environment. So we all have then a negative mother complex, it may be smaller or larger depending on environment, that will be triggered by certain signals even after we become grown up. And the really difficult thing about such a complex is that your feelings in that complex will be like a powerless child, at least your initial feelings when it's triggered. The subjective component of the negative mother complex is the victim child. So when your partner seems to trigger you, you will feel victimized by that person's very manner or demands or whatever, all of which is part of your internal drama. And you will, in some way, because people do this, you will encourage the other person to play the part that is causing you so much difficulty. Usually the way this is encouraged is through projection. And usually, in the regard to the negative mother complex and the negative father complex, the person having the experience feels victimized, and so in some ways unloads the aggressive component on the other person. You know, it goes like this. I'm actually a very nice person. I am conflict avoidant, and you are the one who always causes the this or this or this. I am a Buddhist. I am a pacifist. I don't like conflict. What's the implication there if we're having a conflict? You're the one who's making the conflict happen. Now, when you repeatedly convey something like this to the other person, what are they going to do? They're either going to fight you, become aggressive, or they're going to withdraw and become passive-aggressive. So you will have created, through your interaction, and kind of set it up for the other person to play the aggressive component of your childhood complex. And the more you put it out there, the more it will be in place. The other person essentially picks up, in his or her personality, the script, not because it means the same thing to that person, but because archetypes are universal. We all have the capacity to play somebody else's negative mother or negative father. And so the two individuals then who are in trouble in disillusionment, they have hooked their complexes together in what is called technically a projective identification, in which each of them is projecting some parental, usually parental, sometimes it's sibling, but more likely to be parental, complex into the other, seeing the other one as being the bad one who's created this, feeling victimized. And when people do this together, what you see, and you see it in couples therapy, is that both people feel trapped and victimized. They both feel really hurt, and they may both feel rejected and unappreciated and unseen. And in that state, they're both like children. They're both like, I don't know what to do about this. It's out of my control, you know. And in that state, of course, then the best they can do, if they're fairly respectable people, is to have a kind of a Cold War environment where they sort of avoid each other. They don't talk about really serious things and so on, because they don't want to get back into this awful feeling of, you know, you are the enemy parent that I was trying to get away from in the first place, and now I'm stuck with you again. So there, that's a very brief kind of overview of complex and archetype as it's enacted in a couple relationship in the worst circumstances, with the identification with being the victim child and the projection of the aggressive other into the partner. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know if you were there last night, but that's what I talked about last night. And what I didn't talk about just now, which you touch on, but we probably won't have a lot to talk about, is a lot of time to talk about it, is the development of autonomy in childhood, or the development of an ego complex that's connected with the self, is also something that's kind of going alongside of these other complexes, like mother, father, child complexes. And in a really optimal situation, that individual develops some sense of accountability, responsibility for the self, become somewhat conscious by the time of reaching adulthood. Maybe not psychological awareness, but at least, you know, conscious that I'm responsible for my actions and things like that. Now, what happens with girls is that that kind of development, the development of autonomy and the ability to make your own choices, that type of a development isn't as encouraged in girls as it is in boys. And in a general way, girls are encouraged to be nice, pretty, and popular in terms of the trajectory of their sort of path into society. And they're encouraged to be the object of desire rather than the subject of their own desires. So yes, gender differences have also a role to play in how these things get shaped. But the underlying issue is no matter your gender, you will have had these kinds of experiences and you will have complexes. And those complexes will, even, you know, it doesn't matter if you're male or female, those complexes will lead you to feel like a child in adulthood, especially with your partner, and to feel disempowered with that person. And probably more disempowered and more trapped with your partner than with anybody else. Unless maybe you have a teenage child where you feel the same way with that teenage child. But you won't feel that way with your other friends. You won't feel that way with the neighbors. And so consequently, people come to couples therapy and say, I feel worse with this person than I feel with any of my friends. Isn't that a sign that I should get out of the relationship? No, not necessarily. Just because you feel really bad with this person doesn't mean it's not going to work as a relationship. That's the stage. That's part of a stage. One other thing about divorce, I just want to say a couple of words about it. You probably know that about 52% of first-time married people get divorced these days in this country. About 65% of remarried couples get divorced. About 85% of cohabiting couples split up. So still, the statistics are best for marriage, of all of those statistics. But in some ways, these divorce statistics are good news. They're good news from the point of view of individuation. Because in the past, people didn't get divorced because they didn't expect to have intimate relationships. They saw marriage as a social contract, and it was very possible to be in a marriage over a lifetime and remain the victim child, and to think of yourself as being tortured by the other individual and not to evolve psychologically and to rationalize all of that and to put it out to other people that, you were stuck with the enemy. I know that my parents did that, and they weren't unusual in doing that. My mother was perhaps a little bit more sort of extreme than some in her negative statements about my father, but those statements were justified from the point of view of her perception of what was going on. And what she did, which is something that we're going to see in the video a little bit, she infantilized my father. My father was a little boy when he was at home. He wouldn't get, a glass of water for himself. But that was the very thing that she condemned in him. And so she created the monster that she also condemned, and yet he also did nothing to shift that. And in part, that was the cultural era that he was in, and in part, it was also his personality. He'd had a very traumatic childhood. His father was murdered when my father was 6, and his mother committed suicide when he was 10. And he was in very poor circumstances in West Virginia, so he hadn't really had a very nurturing childhood. So now he was trying to get that nurturance also from his wife. And so you could see how the drama got played out. But this business of infantilizing the man and then attacking him for being a little boy was something that the little red hens did a lot of in my childhood, and they still do, I think, and then they would complain that the others were lazy, like the rat and the cat and the mouse in the story, that they never did anything to help. Now, there are a lot of things going into that story, but it was a very common story in terms of the way that most of us grew up. Those parents didn't get divorced. The divorce statistics are pretty good. They still are very good in Japan. There are fewer divorces in Japan than anywhere in the world, and there are more unhappy marriages in Japan than anywhere in the world. So divorce is no indication that things are one way or the other. having more divorces in this society is both good news and bad. It's good news from the point of view people expect now something of marriage that they hadn't expected previously, and it's bad news from the point of view they don't know how to get that. And so they leave marriages prematurely because they don't know this route from disillusionment to intimacy. So it's not really all that shameful that they don't know the route either, because it's a new route. It's a new path. And so how can you know it when no one else has ever told it to you? You didn't see your parents do it, and many of your friends don't do it. And so, and you don't see it on television or in the movies. Well, how do you find out? You know, it's you are really kind of inventing it as you go along. And then there are people like us who work with couples and do research on couples, like John Gottman here in Seattle. And they begin to say, "Hey, there really is a path." So, the idea of divorce is something in itself that is interesting and needs to be looked at with real care in terms of interpreting divorce statistics. So, can I add something to? Yeah. Well, people used to think, and Harville Hendrix, who has given very nice endorsements to my books, because he took a lot from Hags and Heroes without acknowledging it. And I like Harville, but he thinks that people go out there to kind of find the person that they can, you know, heal with. I think that almost anybody you find will hook in with you if you stay with them. That it's really because there are archetypes that are universal, and we all have fertile ground for playing out these dramas. So you find someone and you have a strong drama going from your side, and lo and behold, they seem to play it out with you. But I think you could probably do that with many, many people. They might play a slightly different part in your internal drama. Like in my first marriage, I definitely was trying not to marry my father. And in the end, I did marry someone who was more like my father, in the sense that he was extremely disappointing. He was so disappointing and so disabled, and my father was like that, that he never really could live up to almost anything. Nice man and intelligent, but just no, he himself had had a very traumatic childhood, just sort of no ability to come through. And then, you know, when I married Ed, I thought that, I mean, visually or sort of physically, Ed is a little bit like my father, and I sort of thought I was marrying a kind of good father. So it turned out I married my mother in various ways, you know, in terms of what he will play out with me, and all of the stuff that I hadn't played out before, now I play out here, but I hadn't expected that, you know, so... You can, you know, you can find yourself in one relationship playing out dynamics from one of your parents, and then in another relationship with the other parent, or if there was an older sibling who played an important role, because sometimes it's the older sibling also that you play out in the marriage. But I don't think it's even that you look around for a good candidate. I just think, you know, it happens. People all have these archetypal tendencies, and they all have complexes. And most all of us are pretty weak in our consciousness, you know, even in... Yeah. Right, when you'd fall in love with them, because they look, when you fall in love, you know, you fall into something that you think is going to really be great. And that it's something you're wanting to develop or you're wanting to move towards. And at different phases of life, of course, people fall in love with different kinds of idealizing projections also. I see so many women in therapy who fall for a nice guy, you know, and they think he's spiritual, but he's only passive-aggressive, actually. And, you know, because the passive-aggressive demeanor can look so spiritual and like such a nice guy. And then they get into it, and they're like, "Whew, you know, not what I thought it was going to be." So, Yeah, the magnetism is the idealizing projection. That gets you, what I say, that gets you through the door. That gets you your ticket, you know, but it doesn't take you on the ride.
I heard a story from a presentation that Marianne Williamson. Someone went up to her and said, why is it that the people I'm really attracted to are the men, it's a woman going up to her, the men I'm really attracted to are the men who are really, really bad for me. And she said, the problem isn't that you're attracted to them, the problem is that you give them your phone number.
Right. Right.
So it's good to think, yeah. You know, what's going on here.
Yeah. In the classical definition, generally things are much more in their essences. Like there is such a thing as, you know, your own negative mother complex that has the core of the terrible mother, and that terrible mother has certain features that are universal. And you would not have the tendency. I don't want to caricature this because I worked with a classical analyst, but the tendency really is to make pronouncements from the analyst's point of view, to make pronouncements about your complex, your dreams, and these figures, reading them almost from mythology. And often the reading comes from Greek mythology even, because it's the mythology that people are familiar with and that stands behind Western culture. In the developmental school, there won't be that kind of pronouncement, and there won't be the reading from the mythological, but rather the looking at the interpersonal dynamic and the individual's fantasies and how those fantasies play out into particular images. I never, in doing analysis and therapy, I don't ever make reference. I don't do the sort of expansion of the image by mythology. I always go through people's associations and their fantasies. If there is some story that seems relevant from mythology, I wait until it comes to my mind many times before I ever speak about it. So I think it would be more in that. It's like an emphasis, and it's like whether, you know, you might say the analyst has, the classical analyst has a pretty strong orientation that will be brought to the work from the point of view, this means this. I almost never say this means this. And sometimes people say to me, well, why haven't we talked about archetypes in here? You're a Jungian. And I say, well, we've been talking about them, but we never mention anything that sounds like that, because I also don't know that something means something. I think meaning changes and it evolves. And in a particular moment, it seems to mean this, and that's much more the way I'll talk. Well, this seems to look like this. Well, let's look at this together and let's explore. And here you seem to be seeing, you know, your partner as though your partner were blah, blah, blah. So I think it's a difference in the emphasis. Yeah. When do they open? You know, I understand least the archetypal approach. My sense is that the archetypal approach, and someone else may want to add something to this, that whereas I, as a developmentalist, really do take the notion of archetype seriously, in the sense that I would say that all human beings are constrained by certain things, that we are constrained by the way that we are embodied, and we're constrained by our emotional memories and so on. My sense is that the archetypalists think of an archetype as an image that's used repeatedly in any culture. So you can have an archetype of a cowboy, for example. For me, that's not an archetype, because archetype means universal. It has to be universal. And so when you get into archetypes of tricksters and so on, I always feel a little hesitant, because I want to be sure that we're talking about, from a developmental point of view, if we're going to say it's an archetype, that there's a universal connection to the way in which that predisposition is going to form into an emotional image. So consequently, you get into a lot of interesting differences, at least between the classical and the developmental, and I would think also the archetypal, when it comes to the self and the predisposition to form an emotionally charged image of an individual subject is the way I define the Jungian archetype of self. And that emotionally charged image is going to be the image of your individual embodiment that you regard as yourself. And it's the universal predisposition to form such an image that exists across human beings no matter their culture. The content of the self, whether it's supposed to be unique, whether it's supposed to represent the group and so on, has much to do with the environment. Now, my sense is that the archetypalists almost dismiss the idea of self altogether. That there is a kind of, maybe I'm wrong about this, please correct me if you're out there. I know there are Pacifica people here, and it's a very, as it's on the East Coast, we call it a Hillmaniac environment, Pacifica. So, but I do think that the archetypalists want to take things very lightly. And they want to relate meaning in terms of image, wherever image occurs, in a repeated way. They want to make that important to pay attention to. And so they're very drawn to the arts and to, theater and all of those aspects of cultural life, where the developmentalists are drawn to infant mother observation, things like that, that they spend a lot of time on. So that's what I think about the archetypalist. I also find when I've heard Jim speak, I mean, over time I have had various dealings with Jim Hillman since 1975, and I have so many reactions. I never really understand fully what he's talking about. And at the same time, he's very brilliant in the way he presents it. So I'm impressed, but not enlightened. And so I'm never quite sure when I come away from something that he's done or a book he's written. I'm not sure that I get the picture completely, but I'm impressed. And my sense is that also is a part of the way the archetypalists operate. When I hear them speak, when I hear them present a case, I'm always really impressed by it. But if somebody says, "Well, what was that about?" I can't usually explain it. And I think maybe, that's also a way that people experience an analysis, and that can be quite transformative, you're very impressed and you're very sort of swept up, but you don't know what it was about. But we developmentalists, we try to explain things, and so do the classical people. They try to explain things. So I hope that's a fairly respectable way of talking about the archetypalist. Okay. That's true. You're right about that. There aren't many Jungians who, I mean, there are some, and I do know some Jungians who are sensation types, but, right. Well, I always think they're probably the airlines pilots and the people that are building the bridges, and I'm so glad that they're not the intuitives that are out there flying airplanes by and large. It's like, oh yeah, I'm flying the plane. I forgot. So, yeah. Well, I am very, very strongly in my type, and I've always tested the same type. And in Jungian audiences, I'm not usually recognized in my type. I'm an INFP, and I have been strongly in that type from the time that I first took the Myers-Briggs and the Gray Wheelwright and the Singer-Loomis, all of which I took when I was in training in the late 70s. And I continue to be very strongly that type. And the thing about the intuitive introverted feeler is that it can look like thinking, or it can look like all sorts of things, because it's kind of masked in a way by the strong introverted feeling function, which picks up lots of little cues. My sense is that a lot of the developmentalists that I know are INFPs also. When I go to London, I feel like I'm with my people, you know. And in general, the English, I think, are more introverted. But these people cue in very closely to the feeling responses, and they rarely pronounce anything as "this means this." You know? But when you're done, they've tracked your feeling response really carefully.
I don't know anything about the type.
Yeah,
I'm an ENFP, I know that. Yeah. We do well with the NF,
yeah.
If you're into this.
Yeah. And all of our kids are NTs in reaction to us. They all know what they know. They know it. And we are stupid by comparison. You know, they've all told us that. Huh? Yeah, I think so. I think it's the 20s, you know, like their young 20s were terrible. They criticized everything about us. I mean, they were critical as teenagers, but they weren't very good critics. When they got to their 20s, they started to be really good critics. They really knew what was wrong with us.
Yeah, there's one thing that's been really difficult for us to do as parents is to really take our authority. We've never done that successfully, consistently.
Right.
And they basically know that, and they're very free with their criticisms, which you know, frankly, I still don't like. But you do learn a lot. You get a lot of feedback.
Right.
You do. You really get a lot of feedback.
And they're all probably going to be very good critics. I mean, they're in a couple of them. One's on his way to medical school. The other one's in graduate school, and. The youngest one is in computers, and they're really being good critics. And
You are a good critic.
Well, I can, yes, I am a critic.
You really have that mind that sees the negative aspects of any potential thing.
But it's right. It's true. No, it's really true. I think it's a skill.
In Buddhism, they have these styles. Jack Kornfield talks about it in The Roots of Buddhist Psychology. And as I remember them, there is the grasping type. They're sort of the Buddhist sort of personality types. The grasping type that comes into a room and sees, ooh, I want one of those. Ooh, I want to be with this person and grab it. Then there is the aversive type, which is more the one who walks into the room and says, I don't think I'm going to like this.
Who knows what's wrong, what doesn't, what they don't like.
No, I don't like this, I don't like that. Check out all, the mind goes to the negative aspects. And then there is the delusional type who walks into the room and says, why did I come here?
I don't remember
what
do why
I really, why, what am I, you know, confused. And of course, we all have aspects of all three, but just like in a type situation, one tends to dominate. Travel somewhere between the grasping and the delusional with a little aversion.
I'm more the aversional and the grasping.
Yeah, that's true.
But anyway, it is interesting about how typology works also with couples. And maybe we'll have some questions about that when we come back later. So why don't we take a break for, say, 15 minutes until noon, and then we'll watch a little video and have some more conversation before lunch. As typical of adolescence and not at all the full development. But if a culture thinks of that as the full outcome of development, it can be quite misleading to the individual, thinking I should develop as an independent person, and that is the mature sort of stage of development, so I should fight off any dependence, either others depending on me or me depending on others. And I think that this in America creates a real problem for marriage and for relationship, is that people regard this as some kind of idealized state to be independent. And it's really a state of anxiety.
Possible state.
Yeah, that it's not even a possible state, but it's also a state of real guardedness and defensiveness. And so then if an individual develops beyond this anxious, guarded independence, then which he calls a quasi-independence because it's not any true independence, but then one develops to what he calls a mature dependence. And mature dependence is characterized by an ability to give and take, to do both, not just to take, but to give and take, in a relationship where you are grateful to the other for your dependence, what the other provides. So a mature dependence is the outcome of development in Fairbairn's system, and it's what I would consider to be a similar thing to intimacy. I mean, I would use those terms interchangeably. And I would also say that if you go on individuating in the Jungian terminology, then eventually, you know, it should be a state of mature dependence, not independence, but depending on others with a sense of maturity and gratitude, and also acknowledging your dependence as the state in which you live. Now, from a Buddhist point of view, that would be also very wise, because we live in an interdependent state all the time. That's reality. And if you fight that, you create suffering. So from all of these different perspectives, this notion that dependence underlies our situation as human beings is very central.
Another way of saying it is a state where one is dependent and is dependable.
Mm-hmm.
You can be both dependent and dependable. That's the mature dependence.
So that's the goal. And in couple relationship, when people get to that state, and there's this, the state is described both as the goal and a certain place where you have to begin. On your green sheet, it says acknowledging the vulnerability of the self and accepting an attachment relationship as its secure base is both where you begin in dialogue therapy, and it's the goal to thoroughly accept that and understand it, and then to respond to your relationship as the place where you live. And so that means that you don't wait for your partner to change in order for you to create a better place. You know, people often say, well, I've done all the changing around here. I'm not doing any more until he changes. And actually, that's another way of saying, I'm willing to live in this polluted state. Just because I'm a stubborn, quasi-independent person, you know, and it's not really a good idea. If you recognize that you're dependent on the relationship for your own development and for your own way of life, then cleaning it up from your side is helpful for you. For your partner, you're doing it for yourself. And when we can help people see this, it's amazing how much they become more responsible for their own internal states and their own enactments and so on.
Can I say one thing? Yeah. It reminds me of I was at a seminar once, and someone used the analogy. This was connected to a work-related problem. Of, like, say you're on an assembly line, and you are someone towards the end of the assembly line, and by the time this thing gets to you, you realize over time that there's a mistake that's being made earlier down the line, and the question was, what is your job? What is your responsibility at that point? You know, your job, in a way, is just, you're not the manager. Your job is to just put your part in and move it along the line. But you know that actually there's something wrong with it. But whose responsibility is it? Should you say something? Should you just go ahead? So they asked the presenter, who is responsible? And the presenter said, the one who's responsible is the one who understands. The one who sees it. Mm-hmm. So the idea in it just takes, you know, people have different capacities in a relationship, and in any particular moment that can change in terms of who has a capacity at a particular moment. So it's not a matter of who's doing the more work or who's doing the more this or the more that. Whoever understands what's going on can make the change.
Has the responsibility. Yeah.
Even more importantly, to do what needs to be done.
So that's the idea of mature dependence. The second step that's on the sheet is the reclaiming of what I, in the book, and You're Not What I Expected, I call these complexes dream lovers, partly because the book is written for the general public, and so I call them positive and negative dream lovers that are projected into the partner. So for stopping these dominance and submission patterns of childhood complexes that are enacted as active or passive aggression. We're not going to have time to talk about anger and aggression before lunch, so we'll talk about it just afterwards, because what we try to do in working with couples, and it's a part of becoming a maturely dependent individual, is to use anger appropriately, and then you do not need to become aggressive with your partner. Aggression is based on fear, and the fear responses are the ones that trigger that emotional memory stuff and get you into an enactment of a complex. And if you handle things through anger, which is a boundary-setting emotion, you don't have to become so afraid of your partner. And over time, you realize that no matter what your partner does, you can handle whatever comes up. Of course, this is also the result of working through many things with that person over time. There's a rule that we established fairly early in dialogue therapy, which is to use anger, not aggression. That aggression does not belong in an intimate relationship, because aggression creates power difference. It creates dominance and submission, which would be antithetical to an intimate relationship, which is based on equality and reciprocity and trust. So then the third, the fourth, and the fifth steps really come after there has been this kind of recognition and the taking of responsibility for one's complexes. And I won't talk about those right now, because we'll talk about them this afternoon. But this process of integrating your own complexes and taking responsibility is called technically differentiation, that you're able to recognize what belongs to you and differentiate what's yours and what's not yours. To some extent, it eventually also means recognizing what does belong to your partner. Although that's not a matter of psychoanalyzing your partner or saying to your partner, aha, acting just like your mother, or things like that. That doesn't work very well. That ends up being an attack of your partner.
Ideally, this differentiation should begin with one's parents. That you begin this process of differentiating in your relationship with your parents somewhere in adolescence or even in young adulthood, that you begin thinking and or saying, look, I don't do it that way, or I have a different point of view, or becoming different than the party line, the way you were raised, and feeling that tension with the parents. Many, many people do not do this. So the process of differentiation for many people gets experienced completely with a partner, where they haven't really done it and practiced it with a parent and started it with a parent, that there's a lot of conflict and a lot of strain, a lot of pain that occurs when one has not in any way really learned this, except when they get married.
Of course, this also depends a little bit on family styles. True. And using the kind of, you know, the Bowenian idea of whether there's too much enmeshment or there's too much, what's the other term he uses other than enmeshment?
Emotional
differentiation,
cutoff.
Emotional cutoff. Or you could say that some families operate through a kind of mutual idealization, and other families operate with a lot of conflict habituation where people attack each other.
Both of those are problematic.
But a lot of times what we find is if there's been an idealization of the parents, or if the parents have either idealized the child or the child was required to idealize the parents, it's very much more difficult to go through the process of differentiation later on. So, and that has to do with narcissistic injury and so on, too.
Also because the person, in that case, is comparing their partner to an ideal.
Yeah, right. And that the parent had never actually met, but always engendered in that individual. So differentiation, and the other component of this process of mature dependence is empathy, is being able to step into the other person's shoes. This is also a skill, and it's something that has to develop over time. And we try to, we do everything we can in dialogue therapy to encourage it, but it's not until the person kind of gets it that they see the function, the importance of empathy. And the way we talk about empathy is that you have to be able to step into the shoes of your partner and see the world from that point of view. You do not have to agree with it. You do not have to validate it. But you do have to see it. And so I often use the analogy of being the anthropologist, you know, that you're like the anthropologist studying the other tribe. You come with respect, you have curiosity, you're interested in their manner and their customs, and so you want to investigate. You don't want to, as an anthropologist, you don't come in and say, I know exactly what's happening here. You know, you come in with the question, well, tell me about it. What's it like from your point of view? How do you see that? And that's very hard to do when you're in an activated state, to come in with that real curiosity and interest about the other person's point of view on the world. And ultimately, empathy also does depend on your ability to say their point of view in some way that they recognize is accurate. And so, you know, that you would say, so here's how you're seeing it. Here's how it looks to you. And if the other person says no, then you have to try again. Sometimes people feel that their partners are torturing them, like, why do I have to talk so long to you? Well, it's usually because the other person doesn't feel that you've heard what's being said. Most people do not really want to waste their time saying the same thing over and over again. The reason they're saying it is that they don't believe they've been understood and been heard. So the whole issue of empathy and being able to step into the other person's shoes is a skill that develops, and it develops really by your willingness to see the relationship as the place where you live, your willingness to practice that.
This is where technique comes in, where you can use technique, just the technique of dialogue, to help you out when you know you're triggered and you cannot rely on what your impulse is or what your own feeling is, because you, if you have enough awareness to know that you're triggered, you can use paraphrasing. We call it paraphrasing. Other people call it mirroring or reflecting back. You can ask questions as a way to get through that little period where you're triggered, just to give yourself some breathing space so you can gradually calm down as you're listening, even though you may not be paying complete attention, because you're also at the same time trying to monitor your own level of arousal or agitation, but knowing that you have to listen, because if you just respond in a kind of knee-jerk way out of what you're feeling, it's not going to go well.
So what Ed said about space is actually the final thing that I want to say this morning, which is that the opposite, and here's the technical thing, the opposite of projective identification is the transcendent function or the potential space, in Winnicott's terms, the play space. Those are exact opposites. When you have a projective identification, when you have a system between the two people where they're locked in, what you find is they always say the same things to each other. There's a repetitive interaction that is so predictable that the two people can tell you, and it's almost like if you say A, then I say B, then you say C, then I say D, and they know in advance how it's going to go, and they feel in themselves a kind of terrible despair when this thing starts, because they know that it's like a machine. It just kind of clicks off. Nothing new ever happens in this particular conversation or in this particular, often the word for it in linguistics is discussion. It's not really even a conversation. It's a discussion. We use these terms like dialogue, conversation, and discussion to mean slightly different things. So when you're engaged in a projective identification where your complexes are linked in, both people feel victimized, and it's a repetitive interaction. It's very predictable. It's very deadening. Projective identification deadens relationship. And what people generally do is avoid actually entering in then to conversation or discussion with each other, because if in a couple that's really chronically stuck, they have come to see that talking about things doesn't lead to any place good, and they feel discouraged because the very thing that they want, which is this intimacy, doesn't even seem to come about by talking to each other. And this is the point where they come to see a couple's therapist, usually. And it's also the point where they'd rather spend the evening with a goldfish than with a partner, you know, because the goldfish is a comfort and the partner isn't.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.